Okay, welcome everybody. Thank you for coming this evening. It's so nice to see you all, and I'm really excited to get to talk with you and explore ideas that I've been playing around with and exploring on my own and with lots of students over many, many years, and to bring this into an opportunity for mindfulness practitioners to get together with social activists and get to have an exploration. So, my name is Janine Skipper, and I am a teacher here at FIMC. And I'll be sharing a little bit more about myself as we go on. But I'd like to just have you all introduce yourselves by, if you'd like, sharing in the chat just where are you broadcasting from and what brought you to this talk tonight. So if you just put a few words in the chat, we can kind of see a little bit about who is here tonight and what brought you here and where are you from. I think we have people from all over the country and internationally tonight. I want to welcome those of you who have not been to FIMC yet, Flagstaff Insight Meditation Community. It's been one of the joys of, I mean, if you can call it a I guess one of the benefits that we all had to go on to Zoom was that we are being able to connect with broader and broader communities of people. And so, those of you who haven't joined us before tonight's talk, we welcome you and welcome you to future events as well. FIMC holds a Monday night sit as a meditation session, as well as many different types of events. And we're working on being able to continue to be able to offer those both hopefully at some point in person as well as remotely. So I see in the chat, we have all kinds of folks joining us from Flagstaff and Mexico, New Mexico, Dallas, Portland, Oregon, Argentina, living in Fort Collins, Colorado, and Denver, Colorado. Wow. That's amazing and really exciting. And so, okay, and people are just interested in engaging in these questions, thought it was an interesting topic. Wonderful. So, here we go. I'm gonna begin by offering a little bit of a talk, and this tonight. You can think of this as a social dharma talk. So while we may think of a dharma talk as a mindfulness talk that explores some aspect of social reality, a social dharma talk may be thought of as a mindfulness talk that explores some aspect of social reality. And some of you may be familiar with dharma talks, but if you're not, you'll get a taste of one here. And just when listening to a Dharma talk, I invite you to listen with a receptive and open mind and heart. I'm also going to include two guided meditations during this talk that I hope you're going to find that you'll enjoy and find meaningful. And perhaps they'll help you connect more deeply with the subjects that we'll be exploring together today. There'll also be time for you to talk with each other, and as well as reflect on your own and with me. And we're going to do this all in 90 minutes. That's the hope. That's the goal. So I hope that our time together sparks some interesting food for thought and reflection for you. So I'd like to begin by sharing the story of how I began uniting consciousness and social change in my teaching. In 1990, I was an undergraduate student majoring in sociology. And during that same time, I took a class where I learned a range of mindfulness practices. And I viewed those two things as separate strands in my life. They were both powerful, but I saw them as separate. And I basically went into sociology, but I was a closet meditator. And over the years, I started to feel like the practice of meditation, mindfulness, was giving me so much insight into the nature of reality and society. I knew that I had to start finding a way of connecting the two. So about 10 years later, I found myself teaching an environment and society class. And I assigned my students this simple exercise. I told them to sit outside on the land, close their eyes, take three deep breaths, open their eyes, and write about their experience. And I asked them, in what ways do you feel connected to your environment? And in what ways do you feel disconnected? And the effect of this simple 5-minute exercise on students was so profound. And I received so much feedback just by asking them to sit on the land and close their eyes and share their experience. They'd never been asked to do something like that before. And many students even told me that it changed their lives. But despite the receptivity that I saw in students and an eagerness to connect to the earth through the simple activity of connecting with their breath, I personally still maintained the separation between a meditation practice and social justice work through sociology. I began sitting with the Flagstaff Insight Meditation community in 2003. And I was finding that the insights that I gained through Buddhism and meditation practices were just as powerful as the sociological insights that I was experiencing through sociology and through teaching. And I saw possibilities for cross-fertilization between the two areas. And by 2006, I began uniting these two areas in a graduate seminar called Consciousness and Social Change. And in this class, I taught the students insight meditation, which is what the type of meditation we do here at FIMC, to empirically examine the nature of their own consciousness. So, that's just to give you a little bit of background of how the two have been uniting in my consciousness over the years. So, as I mentioned, here at FIMC, we practice Vipassana or insight meditation. It's a form of mindfulness practice whereby over time one gains insights into the nature of reality. And I'm sure, as those of you who are practitioners have noticed, that when we meditate over time, we begin to see that our minds create or see how our minds create illusions and how they construct reality. And the Buddha identified three marks of reality that we as practitioners begin to see as we through the practice. And the three marks of reality are dukkha, recognizing that there is suffering. You may notice that in your life, that there is suffering, that to be human is to experience a certain amount of suffering. The second mark is impermanence. And the third mark is no self. There's no separate self, but rather we're interconnected with everything else. And it's this third mark of reality, no self or interconnection, that I want to focus on tonight. So, at the level of collective consciousness in the West, we've been under an illusion. We believe that we're separate from everything else. In particular, believing and acting as though human beings are separate from nature. And Charles Eisenstein has called this the story of separation. And the story of separation assumes that we're all separate from each other, that some humans are superior to other humans, and that human beings are separate from and superior to the rest of the natural world. And believing ourselves to be separate and superior has resulted in one of the most fundamental, taken for granted cultural assumptions, the idea that we're separate from and superior to nature. The idea that we can ceaselessly use nature to feed material prosperity and unabated consumption is now revealing fundamental limits. And I know you all know this. I just want to paint the full picture. So now we're seeing the results of this false perception in our separation from nature. There is only so much production and consumption the planet can support without environmental degradation and climate catastrophe. So mindfulness practices lead to transformations in perception. We begin to see things as they really are. We begin to understand a truer story, the story of interconnection. The reality of interconnection recognizes that all phenomena exist in relationship with each other, right? Things don't appear separate, or as separate and individual, but rather they appear in relationship with everything else that co-arises along with it. So, for example, Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh explains, if you are a poet, you see clearly that there is a cloud floating in this sheet of paper. Without a cloud, there will be no rain. Without rain, the trees cannot grow. Without trees, we cannot make paper. The cloud is essential for the paper to exist. If the cloud is not here, the sheet of paper cannot be here either. So we can say that the cloud and the paper inter are. When we become mindful of our interconnections, we recognize that we're part of the fabric of the whole and that to harm any of the whole results in harm to ourselves. When we recognize the true nature of reality, that everything and everyone is interconnected, we're inspired to act from a place of love, care, compassion, kindness, and respect toward each other and toward all beings. This is the place from which we can begin to heal what I've been calling the human nature split, both personally and collectively. So I'd like to offer a guided meditation so that we can begin to tap into the direct experience of interconnection. So as I said, this talk and exploration is going to be infused with some guided meditations. And so this is the first one. And I invite you to just get comfortable. If you would like, you can maybe turn away from the camera, or you feel free to turn your camera off during the meditation portion, whatever you're comfortable with. And just begin by connecting with your body. I invite you to close your eyes or avert your gaze downward. And just notice your body, the feeling of your legs on your seat, feet on the floor. Noticing any tension. As you notice any tension, maybe you have some tension in your hands, in your mouth, in your stomach. Noticing it, and you can release. As you notice that tension, just relaxing it. Bring your attention to your breath. To the rise and the fall of your stomach as you breathe in and out. Connecting breath to body. Noticing the air as it moves from what appears to be outside of you to commingle within you. Releasing. See if you can notice the space where the air that seems to be outside of you becomes a part of you. Is there a distinct moment when the air from outside becomes the breath within? Where does the outside stop and the inside begin? Where is the moment where the breath is out of it, is air outside of your body, and when it becomes a part of you? We wouldn't be able to breathe if there wasn't water in the air. Consider where the molecules of water that are in the air enabling you to breathe, where they come from. The cloud from which the water collects on the earth. The oceans from which the air, the water evaporates into the air. All forming water molecules that infuse the air and become your breath. Where is the separation? Water cycle is even connected to other beings that serve as distributors, moving water from one place to another. This air, this water becomes part of us. Even at the level of thoughts and ideas that may be arising and passing through your consciousness, where do they come from? Notice the thoughts that run through your mind. See if you can notice where does a thought arise from? Are these thoughts just separate, yours, or do they come from other places? Are these thoughts, do they take on the form of language? They words? Recognizing language comes through your culture. It connects, language connects us to the history of humanity. So we're not separate from any of this. Just take a few moments to notice the ways that you are interconnected, not a separate self. Through your breath, through your thoughts, take three more mindful breaths. When you feel ready, you can open your eyes and rejoin with video if you can. So as mindful practitioners, we begin to see a truer reality and connect to the story of interconnection. Yet this brings challenges as we notice that our social organizations and institutions are rooted in the story of separation. Well, we see the story of separation played out in so many of our institutions and cultural structures. In its most extreme form, war, racism, classism, and sexism. Some of the most common causes of war, economic gain, territorial gain, nationalism, and revenge are based on the idea that one group is separate from another group and seeks gain through war. The story of separation is vividly expressed through border walls throughout the world, a physical and symbolic way of keeping the quote other out. 65 countries around the world have border walls. We've all witnessed some of the ironies of our modern forms of communication, whereby even as we feel connected through social media, we isolate ourselves in our individual worlds while physically sharing the same space. I'm sure that you've seen examples of people who are together in the same social space, but each one is on their own individual cell phones, reinforcing their separation even while connecting through social media. And the story of separation is vividly seen in the human nature split, where we treat the environment as a resource to be redirected for human use, which ultimately has led to abuse and destruction. And there's another challenge. Mindfulness is seen as an individual practice for the benefit of our own individual well-being. Yet this reinforces the story of separation and ultimately many of the social injustices just mentioned. Sometimes I find students come to me feeling like mindfulness is the answer. That if we're just mindfulness, if we can just spread mindfulness and spread it more, positive social change will happen. But over the many years that I've been exploring this, I don't agree with that. Mindfulness alone does not in and of itself lead to social change. And some of the ways that we see this is like through what David Loy calls McMindfulness, where we see many of the institutions that reinforce the story of separation and the problems inherent within that, and exploitation, alienation, encourage mindfulness. They integrate mindfulness practices into their institutions. And what we find is that the workers become more efficient and they become more peaceful. But it doesn't necessarily shift the problems that we see in society. Another really powerful example that was brought to me by a professor of mine in graduate school when I was showing interest in exploring mindfulness and society together. This professor said, well, there's examples of really destructive people who practice mindfulness. The Pentagon, for example, had a meditation group. And so people who were engaged in the project of war could meditate together and just get connected with themselves and not really question the broader frameworks in which they were living and how their ways of their choices of livelihood were impacting others. But mindfulness coupled with a social justice orientation can lead to powerful social change. And we see this in the examples of folks like Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi, and someone who I've just found to be an incredible teacher for me since the beginning of my learning about both sociology and mindfulness, Vietnamese Zen monk and activist Thich Nhat Hanh. And Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us that effective social justice work requires us to cultivate mindfulness, peace, and compassion within. Without mindfulness, we're likely to reproduce the same abusive systems that we seek to transform. So mindfulness needs social justice work in order for it to be transformative. And social justice work, I believe, needs mindfulness in order to also be transformative. Thich Nhat Hanh talks in many of his books about peace and cultivating peace. The one that comes to my mind right now is Peace in Every Step. He talks about how during the Vietnamese War, the peace activists were full of aggression and anger that was directed in, in sometimes very hurtful ways without mindfulness. And that and his feeling was that the peace activists really needed to begin with themselves and be able to cultivate peace in order to be able to have any impact on what was going on in the world outside of themselves. And basically saying peace begins with yourself. Peace begins within. It doesn't end within. And that's the key, I think, here, is that we may need to do this with ourselves, but that is a first step. But if we don't take that first step, then where are we led to? For many of us, as we begin to perceive in more interconnected ways, we feel called to participate in creating social change so that at the level of society, we reflect the reality of interconnection. When we apply our understanding of interconnection to the organizations and groups that we're involved in, we begin to see the possibilities for social change. So I'd like to give you all an opportunity now to explore some thoughts together. We're a medium-sized group, so I'm gonna go ahead and create some breakout rooms so that you can have some smaller discussions right now. And then we'll come back together and talk as a whole group as well. And I'm gonna put in the chat some questions for you to consider. So if you look in the chat, you'll see I have some of these questions, and we'll have about, you'll have about 8 minutes in the group to explore these questions. You may not get to them all. You may choose one over another. I'm going to read them out loud for your consideration. So first one is, consider any number of social institutions, for example, education, corporations, and social media. What shifts are occurring, even if only marginally, that challenge the story of separation and are oriented around an interconnected perspective? So if you can think about how social institutions are starting to change, I have some examples, but I'll let you see if you come up with your own examples to reflect an interconnected perspective versus the individualism that we see that has been so strong, especially in the United States. The second question is, what kind of practices and opportunities might you take to continue to unravel the story of separation within yourself? Recognizing that the story of separation is infused in all of us. If you live in a Western culture, This is the cultural norm that we've all been grown up, that we've all grown up with. And so considering how that story plays out in your own lives and how you may continue to unravel that story. And then the third question, I think, is really important toward uniting all these things and moving towards change. What organizations and institutions are you involved in? And what is one thing you can do to encourage an interconnected perspective? And that goes for all kinds of institutions and or organizations, including meditation groups. So you can consider all of that. Does anybody have any questions before we begin? All right, this is your opportunity to really start engaging with the material. So I am going to put you in some breakout rooms, and I hope you enjoy talking with each other for a little while. Well, welcome back. It's always a good sign when you have a minute to come back to the room and everybody's just waits till the end. So I hopefully you were having great conversations with each other. And I wonder if you would share with the larger group any of the insights or key takeaways from your conversations that so that everybody could benefit from those smaller conversations. Just any key insights, key takeaways. They don't have to be something that you said. It could be something that somebody else said that you found interesting. And feel free to just unmute yourself and share anything that you'd like.
One of the things that I heard people say, and what I was certainly feeling, is that they participated in supporting people, but weren't as active in interconnecting either with the environment or one another as they would like to be. And I find myself kind of going blank, even though as a psychotherapist, I connect with people all day long. And if I have spare time, I go into nature or into my yard and just find a flower or something. But it feels like more of a selfish endeavor from my point of view that I feel a bit, I don't want to use the word desperate, but it almost feels that way to get out and take advantage of it before it disappears. Rather than maybe doing something political or going and pulling invasive plants. It's like it's where I refuel. But again, it feels more of a selfish endeavor where I'm refueling for myself so that I can give elsewhere. But I don't feel like I'm giving in the way I'd like to the
Thank
environment.
you. Thank you for sharing that. That's a really interesting point that you bring up. I wonder if a lot of people here feel like kind of like that feeling like, gosh, I'm not doing enough. I could do more. Is that a common feeling of just like feeling like you're not doing? I think this is a widespread feeling. And it's interesting because when I work with social justice, I wouldn't even say activists. I'd say students of social justice work, scholar activists I work with a lot. There is this general sense that if you're not like out there doing this like really activist work, that somehow you're not contributing. Or there's also a lot of sense that if we are practicing mindfulness, that this is just an individual kind of self-centered endeavor. I really question that. And I can say a little bit more about that, but I wonder if anybody else might want to join in with some thoughts about, how do we do these practices that refuel us, and is that enough, or is there more that we need to be doing?
Well, I guess I would say, that it really is important to nourish ourselves in order to and to have a practice that helps us see reality clearly if we want to act with skillful means, with wisdom and compassion. And I was sharing with my little group that, you know, I'm doing this Upaya chaplaincy, and that's a lot of applied meditations and teachings to support, you know, being in the world with really difficult things, you know, and I feel that the world can be overwhelming, and the problems of the world can be overwhelming. And it's really helpful to be grounded and have ways to nourish oneself so that our actions can be clean, compassionate, wise, and effective. So I really believe in that. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this program. So yeah, I think it's a recognized thing, but maybe not shared enough in our, you know, awake consciousness as it could be.
Nice. Well said. Thank you so much, Sarah. I have very much felt like wise action, right, needs to arise from this place of centeredness, groundedness, connection that we get through these practices, compassion. So thank you. Anybody else want to add to that or raise another point or another insight? Yes, Brian.
I was going to add to that, really. I think I find that the opportunity is to practice it one relationship at a time, one interaction at a time. It may not be a grand gesture, but on a daily basis, there's the opportunity to play it out, the difficult interaction with a, you know, with a coworker or even a stranger. But that's the practicum. At least at this point in my life, I don't feel part of, closely connected to a large group effort in response to sort of the social consciousness initiative, but there's an ongoing opportunity to do it one contact at a time throughout my day with every email exchange, with every interaction.
Wonderful. Thank you. Later on in this, I'd like to also share some of the work that's been done in social network analysis in the field of sociology that I think will also give you even more of a sense of how these little small actions do make a larger difference than you may realize, many of us may realize. Anybody else want to raise some points that you had in your groups or questions that you'd like to raise for the whole group? Uncle Don.
Well, this didn't come up in our group, but talking about this sense of duty, whether it's in the job or whether it's in social activism. Sometimes it's very interesting if you have a sense that you have to be doing something that is very ego-oriented, and it's not the sense of interconnectedness. It's a sense of guilt, and you're neglecting equanimity towards yourself. And if you spend yourself completely in one place, you can't carry on. You take yourself out of the game. People in your life that are interdependent with you will suffer due to your suffering, and you have to keep that in your mindfulness as well.
Wow, thank you. Really appreciate all of that you're all sharing. These are really powerful points. Anybody else want to share some thoughts in this or anything else that you talked about in your group? Maybe one more.
I'd like to just share that on the idea of social activism. For me, it applies to me showing spaces where showing up in places or spaces where I was either denied or unwelcomed. And that's a form of social activism. My parents grew up in the South, the Deep South, and there were a lot of horrors that I won't share with the group, but that traumatized my mom. And so that when I was a kid, I didn't understand why we didn't do the marching when Martin Luther King was marching, and it was in the city that I was. And my mother said, "No, we don't do that." However, her brother had one of my uncles had a very different view, polar opposite view of social activism. But what my mom did do, growing up as a child in the Deep South, picking cotton, grew up and went to NYU and got her master's degree and was working on a doctorate. So that's her social activism. You know, you're not going to deny me what I can get. And I've kind of followed that path rather than going out and marching and having banners and that sort of thing. So.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's an incredible, powerful illustration of that social justice work does not just look like activism, though that's one way that it looks like. It can look exactly like going into spaces where you've not been welcomed, or Brian's example of the little things in one's everyday life. And again, like this is powerful social change. Maybe I'll jump into that, since that's like the direction that we've been moving in for right now. In terms of the work of social network analysis that I wanted to share, let me see. So this is just a little exploration into how inner transformation and social transformation interconnect. And how these little things that we do can make a larger difference than we sometimes realize. So there's this book that you all might be interested in called Connected: The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. And I'll put that into the chat in case you're interested in taking a look. And this has been written by some scientists, Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, which demonstrate how we're all connected by this idea of 3 degrees of separation. They describe their research findings in this way: what we do not only affects our friends, but also affects our friends, friends, friends. So our influence is broader than we realize, and how we act in the world actually means something. So for example, the results of Christakis and Fowler's research showed that the chances that an individual will vote increase if that individual's friends, friends, friends vote, and vice versa. And they give lots of many different types of examples of how our behavior, our individual, what appears as an individual behavior has like this widespread effect. And research indicates that mindfulness practices lead to pro-social behaviors like compassion, empathy, and altruism. And that all of these behaviors arise from a deep sense of interconnection with others. While I haven't seen any social network analysis yet on this, based on the social network research, it seems probable that our mindfulness practices, our recognition of our interconnections, and our social justice work, whatever it may look like, does not just impact us and our behavior in the world, but also impacts others in unseen but very powerful ways. And social justice, social network analysis also offers insights in how we may more effectively spread our ideas and our understanding. So this is really interesting, I find, like how we're connected within groups and organizations matters. So groups where everyone knows each other and they're insular, the ideas stay within the group and they don't spread further. So you can have all these wonderful ideas, but if your group is insular and it's not really bringing in fresh new energy and other people, your ideas aren't really going to spread, is what the research says. But the ideas also don't circulate and get shared in groups that have too few connections. So groups where people really just don't know each other don't tend to spread ideas. However, groups like the Flagstaff Insight Meditation Community, where some of you know each other, and yet there's a continual influx of new members with new ideas and connections being made, these offer powerful opportunities for ideas to spread. So I just wanted to share some of that with you. I also wanted to talk with you about another way to link consciousness and social change. Besides bringing our mindfulness practices into our social institutions, I also find like it's important to do what some have called decolonizing our minds. So when we've practiced mindfulness for a period of time, we begin to identify patterns of thought. And we might think that these are personal. Like we think, this is how my mind works. But our patterns of thought and our structures of mind are not personal. And sociologists examine how we internalize the values, norms, and messages of our culture. So if we carefully examine our own habitual patterns of thinking through mindfulness practices, we begin to see how we've internalized many of our social patterns. And I really like this example from meditation teacher Donald Rothberg, who wrote, "In 1979, the Dalai Lama came to visit the Insight Meditation Society in the United States. He gave a talk and then responded to questions from retreat participants that they had written on file cards. However, one question in particular seemed to stump him. In the question, the retreat participants spoke of not feeling that he deserved love and asked about how to work with that. The Dalai Lama went back and forth with the translator several times before he finally and somewhat brusquely asserted, "You're wrong. You do deserve love." He later said that he was unfamiliar with the level of self-judgment and self-hatred evident in the question. And Rothberg goes on to say that other Asian teachers and some Western teachers have also been surprised by the strong negative self-judgments of many Western practitioners. So it's just an example of how we internalize social patterns. And I'd like to share with you a personal example of how I've internalized social patterns and how mindfulness practices have helped me recognize these internalized social patterns and release myself from them. So maybe you've done this from time to time where you eat quickly in order to get back to work. Has anybody ever done that? Yes. I knew I would often eat quickly during lunch breaks. However, it wasn't until I went on a retreat, a meditation retreat where we were guided to eat mindfully, that I began to see how my quick eating patterns were linked to the greater society's rush toward productivity. So connecting the inner with the larger social patterns. And I started to see that I ate quickly to be efficient with my time. And I basically saw myself as a machine who just needed to process energy in the form of food to keep working. So I was seeing myself as separate from the food and the story of separation. And I saw the food as a means to an end, just eat quickly so I could get back to work. So the practice of mindful eating has helped me connect with each bite of food, which connects me to the earth. And as I'm eating the food, bite by bite, I'm recognizing that I'm connected with that land, the soil that food grew in, the bugs that aerate the soil that make it possible for the food to grow, the rain from the clouds to water some of that food, or the agribusiness that that houses and grows that food, and the exploitive practices that may be involved in that agribusiness, the farm workers who are also having experiences of alienation and exploitation, and their families. And as I eat each bite, I'm eating, I'm connecting, right, to all of this, to the beauty of the land and the earth, the sun, the water, the systems of oppression that enable that food to make its way to my table. And that includes the fossil fuels to deliver the food, and so on and so on and so on. With every bite, with mindful eating, I can recognize my connections, and I can slow down and shift these practices, shift these patterns. So Stephen Batchelor's vision for an ethical secular Buddhism is grounded in, among other things, here's a quote from him, a commitment to an ethics of care founded on empathy, compassion, and love for all creatures, in which practitioners seek to understand and diminish the structural violence of societies and institutions, as well as the roots of violence that are present in themselves. And that's like a lot to take in. I'm going to put that one in the chat too, in case you want to kind of like look that one over. Take a moment. So how may we begin to let go of the habits of mind and the patterns of thought that maintain the story of separation and the structural violence that we've internalized, simply by being immersed in a society rooted in separation from nature and whose social structures are unjust? This is like my big question that I really bring to all of the classes that I teach, the reason why I am a sociologist and a mindfulness practitioner. So in my environmental sociology graduate seminar, students learn about how we internalize certain Western values, like the story of separation and the environmental devastation that arises out of this. And together, we explore how may we begin to unravel the story of separation that we've all internalized and reproduced through, in my case, through the way I was eating, through our actions, our language, our behaviors, and help begin to heal the human nature split. And I begin each class with an opening activity that focuses on healing the human nature split. So towards the end of this past semester, I asked the students to go outside, follow their intuition, and do something that helps them connect or reconnect with the more than human world. And I encouraged them to try to go a little beyond their comfort zones, but they had the caveat, it can't be dangerous or illegal. And so I actually want to invite you all to try out this exercise. Go outside. We'll have 5 minutes. This is a short period of time, but a lot can happen in this period. If you can, go outside and reflect on one step you can take to heal your split with nature. Follow your intuition. Do something that helps you connect or reconnect with the more than human world. So I'm going to put that in the chat, this direction, this little project. Follow your intuition. Do something that helps you connect or reconnect with the human world. And reflect on one step that you can take to help heal your split with nature, which I assume we all have in one way or another. So this is your challenge, and it should be a fun activity for you. I am hopeful. So whenever you're ready, feel free to just step outside for a few moments, and we'll return in 5 minutes. I'd like to close with another practice that I find very useful in cultivating interconnection and unraveling a false sense of separation and otherness, which I often use to close Dharma talks, and that is metta, loving kindness meditation. And I find this meditation over time extremely transformative. So we'll just do a short, basically 2 or 3 minute metta, loving kindness meditation. And then maybe afterward, if anybody would like to stay and talk for a little longer, or in your own way, maybe you might want to continue that practice or another one on your own afterwards. So just to close this time together. And again, I invite you to close your eyes. Connect with your breath. The breath is an anchor into present moment awareness. It doesn't exist in the past or the future. It's always right here, right now. Bring your attention into your heart space. Sometimes it helps to just put your hand on your heart. Let yourself feel into that space. Bring to mind someone who you care about. That feels someone who brings joy and kindness into your life. Could be another person, it could be a pet, it can even be a place. With metta practice, loving kindness, we just begin with ourselves, offering ourselves kindness and wishes for well-being. And I have some phrases that I use, and you can, you know, tap into the own phrases that work for you. I'll just guide you through this using the phrases that I use as we expand our heart to embrace ever larger circles of beings. Starting with ourself, may I be free of suffering. May I touch joy and peace. May I be warm and tender. May I have ease of well-being. May I be free. Just wishing ourselves to be free. And expanding our hearts in a larger circle of well-being, embracing those who are near and dear to us and wishing them well. May those who are near and dear to me be free of suffering. May they touch joy and peace. May they be warm and tender. May they have ease of well-being. May they be free. And knowing that so many others are suffering, and that many of the ways in which they express their suffering is through harming others, may they be free too. May they be free of their suffering and bring more joy and peace into the world. May all those who we connect with, as we are all connected, be free from suffering. May they touch peace and joy. May they be warm and tender and have ease of well-being. May all those who we connect to in our lives be free. And in this practice, we let our hearts expand so that ultimately we are touching all beings everywhere, throughout space and time. May all beings be free of suffering. May we all touch joy and peace. May all beings be warm and tender, safe from harm. May all beings have ease of well-being. May we all be free. When you begin to embrace all beings in your heart, you become the change you want to see in the world. Thank you for being here tonight and for your practice and for your presence.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.